thank you and goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A young Palestinian man dies of his wounds sustained in the recent Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip, raising the death toll to 255. Millions in Australia's second largest city of Melbourne are ordered into a week-long lockdown amid the outbreak of a highly infectious variant of COVID-19. Colombians take to the streets of Bogota in a new day of protest as the country approaches a month of anti-government demonstrations. Thank you for joining us. Our top story for this hour, one more Palestinian has succumbed to injuries he had sustained during the recent Israeli aggression on the besieged Gaza Strip. The young Gazan was injured during Israeli attacks on El Burj camp more than a week ago. His death brings to 255 the number of Palestinians who have lost their lives in 11 days of Israeli airstrikes and shelling. 66 children and 39 women are among the victims. According to Gaza's health ministry, over 1,900 people were also injured before a ceasefire last Friday. Prominent rights groups say Israel's killing of children could amount to war crimes.
During the Israeli escalation in the Gaza Strip, the regime's warplanes bombed the home of Abu Hatab family, killing 10 of its members. Nadine, a 10-year-old girl, had a terrible experience where the Israeli regime bombed her neighbors in Shatta refugee camp, killing 8 children and 2 women. She survived the attack and promised to make it known to the whole world. She published the details of the Israeli massacre of Al-Hadidi and Abu Hatab families in an air raid just the night before Eid al-Fitr.
The whole family was sleeping, and it was a hard bombing, really hard bombing, that we all woke up scared and terrified, asking ourselves are we dead, or are we still alive? I asked that question first when I just woke up, and then my mom said, wake up, come on, go sleep in the hallway, it's safer for you. So we put 2 mattresses and decided to sleep on the floor where it's really next to the door, so if something happens, we just can open the door and run away. The first day of the Eid, and we're seeing death. we're seeing explosion. My hands were shaking, my legs were shaking because I did not want to see the people cry near that house.
Nadine also talks about the bad humanitarian conditions in Gaza and what children are suffering as a result of the constant bombardment. She talks about them being deprived of proper education amid terror and fear.
As a child, I still don't have any rights because my right to learn is gone. My right to live in safety is gone. My right to love is gone. My right to be healthy is gone. It's nothing hard. I'm just going to ask you a simple thing that they should do. Just stop selling the occupiers' weapons. It's just a simple thing. It's a simple thing that everyone can do. Like, stop selling them weapons. They're using it for bad, not for good. We're using our strong words for good.
Nadine is brave enough to shed light through social media on the tragedy that residents of the Gaza Strip are experiencing. She's doing this by sharing posts, tweets, and videos in English of the massacres committed by Israel and of the homes it destroyed in order to make the voice of the victims heard.
I want the world to understand that we in here are suffering when other kids out there are having fun with their holidays. Like, the day is like the... We did not have, like, the all of the Eid, the 3 days of the Eid, we did not see happiness. We said we saw sadness, and we did not see any happiness. I locked my door and just sit on my bed and just tell all the words that means a lot to me. And means, like, words that are really strong. I say all of those words out there, imagining that one of the occupiers from the army are in front of me.
Nadine, who wishes to become a doctor to help her people, felt helpless about the Israeli massacres, but she found the English language an opportunity to tell the world the truth about what was happening. She wishes to lead a normal life like other children. The Israeli airstrike over Gaza killed children and women and did psychological harm to other children. However, this didn't scare Nadine and couldn't stop her from exposing the truth to the world and asking the international community to stop the Israeli crimes over Gaza. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Now, a senior leader of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned Israel that rockets from the besieged Gaza Strip can easily hit the cities of Tel Aviv and Haifa.
Now, when we have your brothers and your sons in Nazuddin al-Qassam and other factions of the resistance, they have hundreds of rockets, not Grad 20 kilometers of Grad rockets or Katyusha rockets. They have rockets that can, with only one, they can hit Tel Aviv strongly. We will hit Tel Aviv and we will hit Haifa, and I tell you to be at ease and rest in peace.
Yahya Sinwar also said it would be an act of foolishness if Israel does not heed such warnings by resistance groups. He added that Israel was defeated and humiliated in its recent 11 days of deadly aggression against Gaza. Sinwar underlined that Palestinians exhaust all possibilities and sacrifice everything to defend their land and their holy sites in the occupied territories. The Hamas leader stressed that Palestinians will continue their fighting against Israel until all Palestinians return to their homeland. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinians protesting against the planned eviction of several families from their homes in occupied East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. A Palestinian man was arrested during the demonstration. Following the rally, an Israeli court postponed its decision on an appeal filed by two of the families facing eviction. Seven families in the Sinwar district were ordered to leave their homes in 2020. Dozens of households are also fighting similar orders in the city's Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Amnesty International has denounced the eviction orders as yet another example of Israel's criminal policy of forced displacement of Palestinians. The rights group says the recent local and worldwide protests against Israel's forced evictions show the regime's illegal land grabs will not go unnoticed. And the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has slammed the remarks made by the French foreign minister who warned of, quote, possible long-lasting apartheid in Israel. Following the recent conflict between Israel and Palestine, Jean-Yves Le Drian said that the risk of apartheid is high without an independent Palestinian state. Netanyahu has slammed Le Drian's remarks as a brazen, false claim and without any foundation. He added that Tel Aviv will not accept what he called any hypocritical and mendacious moralizing on this issue. Israeli airstrikes and artillery fire on the Gaza Strip killed 253 Palestinians, including 66 children, and wounded more than 1,900 others in 11 days of aggression. Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations has called for beginning an end to shielding terrorist groups in Syria. Majid Takht Ravanchi denounced the categorization of terrorists as good, bad, and moderate. He added that Syria's unity, sovereignty, and territorial integrity must be restored. He said this could be achieved only through ending the Israeli occupation of the Golan Heights and the withdrawal of uninvited foreign forces. The Iranian UN envoy warned against politicizing humanitarian assistance to Syria and condemned the use of food and medicines as weapons. Takht Ravanchi urged the removal of unilateral sanctions on Syria, branding them as immoral and unlawful. He said such measures prolong the suffering of ordinary people. Turning to some coronavirus news now, and Australia's state of Victoria has been ordered to enter a 7-day lockdown amid growing concerns over the spread of a new coronavirus variant. The stay-at-home order is being applied to more than 5 million people in the state's capital, Melbourne, and surrounding areas. Schools and restaurants will be closed and public gatherings will be banned. The restrictions come amid the detection of 26 new cases of COVID-19 in Victoria. Officials link the new cases to the new coronavirus variant, first detected in India. They blame a sluggish vaccine rollout and hotel quarantine failures for the new outbreak in the country's second populous state. This is the fourth time Victoria is going under lockdown since the start of the pandemic. And EU leaders ignore a plea from the World Health Organization to prioritize the vaccination of vulnerable people around the world from COVID-19 before inoculating children living in the 27-nation bloc. Health experts warn that the EU's strategy could backfire due to the rise of new variants. Jerome Hughes has the details.
At a summit in Brussels, EU leaders have taken the highly controversial decision to advance plans on the vaccination of children against COVID-19. The European Commission says more than 300 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine will have been delivered to EU member states by the end of this week.
If we continue like this, we have confidence that we will be able to safely reopen our societies. So we must now focus on consolidating this progress. One important element that we've been discussing is the vaccination of minors.
EU leaders have chosen to completely ignore a plea from the World Health Organization. The WHO clearly states that vaccinating children and other low-risk groups in the EU happens at the expense of health workers and high-risk groups in poorer countries.
The People's Vaccine Alliance is a coalition of more than 50 organizations. In an extensive survey of epidemiologists commissioned by the Alliance, two-thirds warned mutations could render current COVID vaccines ineffective within a year. Hence the need, they stress, to vaccinate the world, not just rich countries.
EU leaders are under enormous pressure to somehow save the bloc's floundering economy, and they see the vaccination of their own people as the key. Millions have lost their jobs in the EU. Young adults have been worst affected. Experts we have been speaking to say the EU has given young people limited skills, particularly when it comes to the digital economy.
We need to change and constantly update our educational systems. And not only educational, we need to speak about the learning as such, which is much wider concept than what is being taught in schools.
The EU is facing unparalleled economic and social crises. Critics say the vaccine rollout was happening much too slowly. Now, as it speeds up, it's perpetrating, quote, scandalous inequality in the context of poorer countries, according to the WHO. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Unions fear a social bomb is about to go off in Italy as millions of jobs will be wasted when a COVID-linked firing ban is about to expire in a few weeks. Unionists are accusing the government of just listening to entrepreneurs' demands. Max Cividi reports from Rome.
A social bomb is about to explode in Italy, according to the country's three major trade unions, CGL, CISL and UIL. Around 2 million jobs are at risk due to a planned end to a ban on individual and collective dismissals on July the 1st, UIL Union warned on Wednesday. The measure had been adopted by the government to counter the economic crisis triggered by the COVID-19.
It is going to be a social bomb for the Italian society, with workers and families paying the highest price for the COVID crisis. The government must give the workers a response in order to stop the social bomb going off with social security cushions.
Also, the Bank of Italy has predicted severe consequences following the end of the firing ban, even though its estimate is set at 500,000 jobs wasted. Unions have accused the Draghi government of just listening to industrial employers' body Confindustria, with businesses having been received three-quarters of government COVID relief.
However, not everybody agrees on the fact that millions of jobs will be wasted when the firing ban ends. Some analysts have argued the layoffs will be fairly unlikely, with the Italian economy set to significantly improve in the coming months.
I believe we have to support Italy's economic recovery by investing on digital innovation and environment-related projects. We have to focus on workers, but also on the country's companies, or there won't be any recovery. We don't have a crystal ball. It's hard to say if there will be an economic recovery any soon. The only thing we can do is to put together a number of tools to enhance it.
Despite the daunting socioeconomic challenges that the pandemic has been posed for Italy, the country still accounts for 17% of industrial production in the European Union, making it second only to Germany at 30%. Rome's economic recovery will very much depend on its ability to spend over 200 billion euros it is set to get from the EU's COVID-19 recovery. Max Civili, Rome.
A teenage protester has been killed during a rally in Western Colombia as the country approaches a month of anti-government demonstrations. The 18-year-old university student was killed from what appeared to be a gunshot wound sustained during a protest late Tuesday in the city of Tuluá. The police said the victim was shot when a peaceful march was interrupted by men who hurled rocks at police and set fire to the courthouse. The student's death brings to 44 the official toll since the protest started on April the 28th. The rallies initially started by a now-ditched tax reform, but later changed into demanding government action to tackle poverty, police violence, and inequalities in the healthcare and education systems. Brings the end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
application on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Immortal lessons of a crucial battle. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, friends. And today we would be presenting to you an exclusive feature on a special occasion, the lessons of which have remained immortal for all seekers of truth for the past millennium and four centuries. Stay with us, please. When you were fleeing without paying any attention to anyone, while the Prophet was calling you from your ear, he requited you with grief upon grief. So, you may not grieve for what you lose, nor for what befalls you, and Allah is well aware of what you do. Then he sent down to you safety after grief, a drowsiness that came over a group of you, while another group, anxious only about themselves, entertained false notions about Allah, notions of pagan ignorance. They say, "Do we have any role in the matter?" Say, "Indeed, the matter belongs totally to Allah." They hide in their hearts what they do not disclose to you. They say, had we any role in the matter, we would not have been slain here. Say, even if you had remained in your houses, those destined to be slain would have set out toward the places where they were laid to rest, so that Allah may test what is in your breasts, and that He may purge what is in your hearts, and Allah knows best what is in the breast. Those of you who fled on the day when the two hosts met, only Satan had made them stumble because of some of their deeds. Certainly, Allah has excused them, for Allah is all forgiving, all forbearing. Dear listeners, what you heard were the ayahs 153, 154, and 155 of Surah Al-Imran of the Noble Quran, in which the All-Wise Creator has immortalized certain events so that mankind may heed the lessons of history in order to differentiate between truth and falsehood. Today, the 15th of Shawwal, is the anniversary of one such event that occurred in the year 3 AH, when the pagan Arabs of Mecca descended upon Medina with a massive force of well-equipped infidels, intent on avenging the disastrous defeat they had suffered a year before at Badr at the hands of a mere 313 ill-equipped Muslims, when they imposed the first ever armed encounter upon Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The new Muslims in Medina, among whom there was a sizable number of those who pay only lip service to Islam but were devoid of faith in their hearts, were terrified at the prospects of risking their life in fighting such a force. Some proposed they should stay in Medina and allow the Meccan polytheists to enter the city so that they can fight them in the streets from the safety of their homes without much risk to life. Others frowned upon such an idea by pointing out the risk to the honor of their womenfolk and the danger to their children if the invaders managed to get the upper hand. It was thus decided to meet the invading force outside the city near Mount Uhud. But no sooner than the Prophet marched forth, a large group of several hundred hypocrites left him and returned to the city. Undaunted, the Prophet of Peace arranged his forces in battle ranks and gave clear-cut instructions to the guards he had posted on the mountain against leaving their positions. The pagan Arabs charged, but the Muslims held their ground. And thanks to the valor and swordsmanship of the Prophet's uncle Hamza, as well as the Prophet's dear cousin, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon them, the pagan Arabs retreated, leaving behind their camp baggage. On seeing this sight, a group of weak-willed Muslims went for the spoils, and the guards at the mountain pass joined in the loot in disobedience to the Prophet's instructions against leaving the place unguarded. This was the very opportunity for which a force of pagan Arabs led by Khalid ibn Walid was lying in wait, and it immediately burst upon the Muslims, making most of them flee the battlefield. The excuse which the fleeing neo-Muslims later proffered was that the Prophet had been martyred and it was now pointless for them to endanger their life for the sake of Islam. This is firm indication of the lack of faith in Islam of the majority of Sahaba, or Prophet's companions, especially in view of the refusal to heed the voice of the Prophet, who was alive and was exhorting them to stay their ground. God Almighty refers to this fact in Ayah 144 of Surah Al-Imran in the Noble Quran. Muhammad is but a prophet. Other prophets have passed before him. If he dies or is slain, will you turn back on your heels? Anyone who turns back on his heels will not harm Allah in the least, and soon Allah will reward the grateful. Among the grateful that Allah rewarded on the day of Uhud was the martyr Hamza, peace upon him. He was struck from behind a tree by the coward Wahshi, who ripped apart the liver of his victim and presented it for chewing in the cannibalistic manner of present-day Salafi Takfiri terrorists to his mistress Hind, the wife of the Umayyad pagan chief Abu Sufyan. The near disaster for the Muslims was averted by the steadfastness of Imam Ali, peace upon him, who shielded his cousin, the Prophet, without the least weakness and with full dignity and honor. As the Noble Quran says in Ayah 146 of Surah Al-Imran, how many a prophet there has been with whom a multitude of godly men fought. They did not falter for what befell them in the way of Allah. Neither did they weaken, nor did they abase them, and Allah loves the steadfast. By pondering on the ayahs of the Noble Quran, we realize that the Lord Most High has praised the one and only commander of the faithful for his valor. Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, was a person who had saved Islam and the life of the seal of messengers at the Battle of Uhud, as Archangel Gabriel was heard singing his phrase, La fata illa Ali la saif illa Zulfaqar. There is no brave youth except Ali and no flashing sword except Zulfaqar, the twin-bladed.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Saudi Arabia, one of the major belligerents in the all-out war against Yemen. Armed to the teeth with state-of-the-art weapons, Saudi top brass were under the impression that they would win the war easily. Their miscalculation, however, has resulted in a war of attrition, which has caused a loss of morale within the army. The Saudis are now faced with the double whammy of the Yemeni Ansarullah movement gaining ground steadily since the breakout of the war and the increasing number of low-spirited forces
who are sick and tired of a meaningless war. Saudi Leaks has recently published a report revealing a wave of executions of Saudi soldiers. According to the whistleblowing website, the Saudis recently sentenced to death a number of soldiers who had refused to fight in the Yemen war. Yet such barbaric measures have not helped the Saudi soldiers restore their morale in the battlefield.
So we're seeing a lot of defections in the Saudi army, but more interestingly than that, there are actually a lot of defections into the Ansar Allah that have happened from the Saudi army. When there have been captures, you know, in Yemen by the Saudi mercenaries, a lot of them, you know, more drawn to the cause of the Ansar Allah, more even drawn to their humanity and approach in treating captives and soldiers, they've actually been defecting over. So the Saudi army, just like the Zionist occupying army, it's facing a huge crisis of morale from its own soldiers. There is really nothing that is, there's no cause or no reason that's really keeping them together.
Meanwhile, the Saudi opposition National Assembly Party has warned of new round of executions, pointing out, with all these heavy losses, and in light of the continuation of this war and its mistakes and risks, we were surprised by the Saudi authorities by announcing the execution of the three soldiers.
The Saudi army doesn't even really know how to fight. A lot of their weapons capabilities and their capabilities during the siege have just been imported or bought off. So there isn't really a cohesive Saudi army to begin with as far as the fighting force. But what we're seeing now is coming into collapse. Lots of defections, as I mentioned. And so, obviously, like with the recent executions, it's showing that this is like a major threat of what's left of the Saudi army.
Made up of Saudi dissidents living in exile, the National Assembly Party says the executions were carried out in complete ambiguity and absence of fair trials. These soldiers are convicted on high treason charges. Breaking down the charges, Saudi Leak writes, these soldiers have refused to take part in the war, to bomb Yemeni civilians, to destruct Yemeni infrastructure, or to carry out the scorched earth policy in Yemen, which is pursued from time to time.
The economic losses that the Saudi regime has incurred, it's also affected their army, which is weak. It doesn't know how to fight. It doesn't know how to, it doesn't have anything to fight for, really. So I'm definitely not surprised that the morale has gone the same way that the American occupying army has in Iraq, at the end of the Iraq War, or that the Zionist army is finding themselves in right now. Any unjust war fought is going to have that effect on the occupying army that is fighting it and causing atrocities.
Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is under fire for his rash decision to declare war against neighboring Yemen in a failed bid to establish his foothold in the region as a rising star in the political sphere of the region.
Well, definitely the Saudi army has faced a crushing defeat from the Yemeni resistance, and the Saudi army was never really a army that knew how to fight to begin with. We saw in Yemen there were huge numbers of mercenaries just imported from Sudan, imported from, you know, other poor countries in the world. And essentially you can't really build an army just by buying them off. Saudis have never had to really defend their territory. They've always just been fake like comprador nation that has been bought off and built off their ability to be bought off too.
In addition to the war itself, there have been a number of other things that have affected the situation. One of them having to do with the kingdom's deteriorating economy. The Saudi forces are complaining about low salaries, poor health services, slashed bonuses, and widespread administrative corruption in the Saudi military, to say the least. To top it all, these soldiers cannot freely express their concerns, as they know any objection might cost them dearly.
Well, the losses that have been inflicted by the resistance onto the Saudi army have also definitely been great enough to, you know, impact them considerably. Saudi Arabia has had its, oil and gas production facilities hit and targeted by the resistance successfully. So the economic losses that have both gone the east in this war, as well as the failure of the weapons defense systems that Saudi Arabia has invested huge amounts of money in, as well as the losses incurred by losing militarily, have definitely had their toll on the regime's ability to pay off its mercenaries.
The Saudis are experiencing one humiliating defeat after another. They have proven to be too incompetent to win a war, even against the poorest country in the region. At the same time, they have been too vulnerable against the counterattacks mounted by the Ansarullah movement, all despite being one of the world's largest military spenders. It's a reminder that military superiority is no guarantee for military success.
We see all the weapons and all the money in the world cannot build an army, essentially. The Saudis have never been able to fight on their own. They've never been able to fight, period. And especially during this siege, everything, as I've mentioned, has just been imported and bought off on the part of the Saudi army. None of it actually comes to its own merits or capabilities in warfare and in battle, which are non-existent. And it's the same thing with the Zionist entity, too. The same exact story. And with the United States. No army as far as a force of people that actually fight or have something to fight for, essentially. Just weapons, technology that are futile against popular forces.
The fact is, the Saudi military is simply too large, but inadequately organized, and with the personnel who have received insufficient training. Moreover, there are a lot of tribal factions within the Saudi military, which have created an atmosphere of mistrust in the establishment. There are reports of growing discontent with the Saudi military or with the mismanagement of the war by King Salman and his son. Whereas the Saudi airstrike campaign has proven to be largely unsuccessful, the Saudis have not been able to accomplish any of their stated goals on the ground. 6 years into the Yemen war, Riyadh has yet to figure out how to send its forces into the battlefield against one of the most deprived fighters in the world.
In the limelight. Senate Republicans have signaled disappointment in the White House's updated infrastructure bill since it was offered on Friday, 21st of May, and negotiations appear to be at a standstill despite the $550 billion cut in funding size. The article you're about to hear has been taken from the website usnews.com and written by reporter and journalist Elliot Davis. The piece is titled Republicans' White House at Impasse Over Infrastructure Bill. Senate Republicans have signaled disappointment in the White House's updated infrastructure bill since it was offered on Friday, 21st of May, and negotiations appear to be at a standstill despite the $550 billion cut in funding size. The two sides even seem further apart now than they were when negotiations began, according to a statement reported by the Associated Press from an aide to Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, who is leading discussions on the Republican side. President Joe Biden and other senior officials have met with a group of Republican senators several times in recent weeks, both at the White House and on Capitol Hill. While full details on the updated package, which has been reduced in size from $2.25 trillion to $1.7 trillion, have not yet been made public by the Biden administration. White House Press Secretary, though, Jen Psaki, has described the bill's trimming as mainly being focused on research and development, broadband, and funding for bridges, roads, and other major projects to come closer to the number proposed by the senators. A White House memo obtained by the Associated Press notes that the cut of research and development funds alone account for $480 billion of the $550 billion total removed from the proposal. In our view, this is the act, the art, I should say, of seeking common ground, Jen Psaki said during a Friday press briefing. She added, this proposal exhibits a willingness to come down in size, giving on some areas that are important to the president, otherwise they wouldn't have been in the proposal, while also staying firm in areas that are most vital to rebuilding our infrastructure. The differences appear to be about the two sides' definition of infrastructure rather than the total cost of the bill. Our biggest gap is defining what infrastructure is, GOP Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri said during a Fox News Sunday interview over the weekend. Republican Senator Roy Blunt added, if we get to a definition of infrastructure that the country would have always accepted, that becomes a much narrower space than it appears to be right now. The two sides also remain at odds over how the massive proposal will be paid for. Republicans have reportedly floated paying for the package through user fees, such as a gas tax. But White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki said on Friday that President Biden is not willing to raise taxes on Americans earning under $400,000 a year through such fees. But Republicans also remain opposed to the tax hikes associated with the White House proposal, with Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky saying during a Thursday Fox Business interview that his side is going to fight it the whole way. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said during a press briefing last week that while she would not expect the bill to be on the floor before Memorial Day, the administration's hope is that we will have a better sense on the path forward and what the opportunity is looking ahead, right before or around the holiday. With talks seemingly at an impasse, it is difficult to predict what progress will look like in a week's time. But GOP Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri said during his Sunday television interview that he thinks the two sides have a week or 10 days to to decide if we can work together on this or not. At least some Democrats are pushing President Biden to push forward without the support of his counterparts. Despite President Biden's efforts to engage with Republicans, they have shown no willingness whatsoever to negotiate in good faith with Democrats to confront the intersecting crises we face, Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts said in a statement on Friday. He added, "Voters, cross party lines, support President Biden's vision and the American job and family plans. Let's not waste time trading the necessary scope and scale of this critical infrastructure package for congressional Republican votes that have yet to and will never materialize." The Biden administration has signaled that it is ready to move on when and if it's necessary. President Biden wants a deal and he wants it soon. There are meaningful negotiations taking place in a bipartisan manner. He's willing to let that play out, Cedric Richmond, a White House senior advisor and director of the Office of Public Engagement, said during a Sunday television appearance on CNN. Cedric Richmond added, "But again, he will not let inaction be the answer, and when he gets to the point where it looks like that is inevitable, you'll see him change course."
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you.
Because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Muslim Lady. We're proud to bring you this show only on IRB English Radio. And of course, in the studio, as always, I have my special guest and darling sister, Sister Razia Shamini. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Dear Zainab, happy to be here.
I'm totally excited to have you with us again so we can continue our active discussion. On today's episode of Muslim Lady, we've been talking about things men and women or boys and girls, whatever age they're getting married at, whether you advocate young marriage or mature, getting like stable in your life sort of scenario kind of marriage, whichever team you're on. We were talking about the criteria that they should look in their spouses and the things that they should be super duper mindful of when selecting a future wife or husband. And it is very significant because it doesn't just affect our lives and the lives of our family members and that person's life and their family member's life, but it affects our children, our potential children, and the lineage and generation that's going to be produced from us, you know?
Sure.
If you choose a horrible spouse and they end up being abusive or mentally unstable or religiously corrupt, morally corrupt, and you have children with them and your children are raised in an unhealthy environment, they're going to be broken people sent out to society who can't function probably. And then they're going to affect other people's lives and the world's going to be a miserable place. So choose your spouse correctly. So on the last episode of Muslim Lady, Sister Razia, you talked about three criteria that a man should not have. He should not be ill-tempered. He should not have a foul mouth. And he should not be... He should have good akhlaq,
right?
Basically,
not aggressive, not have a bad tongue, and to have a good akhlaq, and most importantly, which we have like talked and repeated so many times, is that there are so many beautiful prayers that there's actually one that we will inshallah mention later on as we go talk about the time of conception, that you know what prayer the couple should say, that the man actually says to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, thank you that you have made this girl or this lady mahram or halal to me, and I have taken her as your trust. So trustworthiness,
that's beautiful.
This is one of the special qualities that a man should have in life. That you can, that you know, there's this tradition in many Muslim societies where at the wedding night, the girl's father puts his daughter's hand in the groom's hand and says, I entrust my daughter to you as an amana, as a trust of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And there are so many ahadith that the girl, this girl whom we're going to talk about what qualities she should have as, you know, a good woman, a good spouse, she is an amana.
That's
this
beautiful.
Is so, it's difficult. This is responsibility, man,
exactly.
You know? You're not just getting anyone.
Yeah, not a servant, not a toy, not a playmate, a responsibility.
Her emotions, her thoughts, her psychological health, her physical health, her prosperity in this world and the next, to a great extent, is linked to how you treat her, because she is the trust of God, and this is... If we say ar-rajal qawwamun 'ala an-nisa, so many people argue that why are men in charge? Why do they have the, you know, this this right of, you know, managing? But this is actually a responsibility, and they will be questioned about it. And every, you know, mithqala dharratan khayran yara and mithqala dharratan sharran yara, it's tiny weeny particle of, you know, how they treat the spouse is to be considered and accounted. And this is
scary.
Very difficult.
I mean, look at it that way. It's really scary that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the smallest particle of good that you do is accountable, and the smallest particle of bad that you do is accountable. So As we mentioned, the previous episode of Muslim Lady, we talked about the criteria that a man should possess in order for the woman to be watchful for and select that in her husband. What are the criteria that a woman should possess?
Sure. Well, there are so many different ones. A common criterion between a man and a woman in spouse selection is faith, iman, to really have a good...
A God-centric mentality.
Exactly. Which directs your lifestyle.
Beautiful.
Right? It's not just like, yeah, I believe in this or...
I believe in this ambiguous entity.
Exactly.
That, you know, I pray to sometimes when I'm stressed out.
Yeah. Or you just pray every time, but then you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Faith. And the practical implementation of faith, which is taqwa or fear of God or being God-wariness, having this a break, you know, like you're driving a car. Mm. And then when you have this gas pedal and the brake pedal, this taqwa is the brake pedal.
Right.
Right? That, you know, when...
Restrains you.
Yeah. That really controls you because of the fear that you have for God, right? And I'm not just talking about, you know, oh, you're going to go to hell. Well, you know, we have talked about this
before. It's because, like, they have God as their priority in life.
Exactly.
Satisfying Allah is their priority. Everything else comes in second and comes aligned to that objective.
Exactly. And there's a whole discussion that, like, we do every single act in